Hello everyone, this is Caroline Ford from the UK, speaking to you on a lovely sunny evening in June. Today I'd like to do a career podcast, as I've very much enjoyed those which I've listened to from the BCT website. In case anyone's interested in the equipment I'm using, I've got an Olympus WS320M voice recorder with an external microphone. And thanks very much to Paul Hopkins for recommending this microphone to me. If anyone has any comments or questions about this podcast, please feel free to get in contact with me. I'm on the BCT mailing list. My career has had three distinct parts so far. Part three is still ongoing, and I'm not sure if there'll be a part four or not. I'll just have to wait and see. But going back to the beginning, when I left school at the age of 18, I really didn't have any clear idea of what I wanted to do. I knew I didn't want to go into teaching, like my mum, and I didn't want to go into the law, like my dad and my sister. I found out, though, that the RNIB was doing a course in London, teaching people the basics of computer programming. And as I was interested in languages and computers, I decided to give this a go. The course only lasted about 3 months, but it was an ideal introduction to the subject and gave me the opportunity to see if this was going to be a suitable career for me. We studied COBOL and assembler language, and I quite enjoyed the course. But when the course was over, I was undecided about what to do. I needed more training, really, to get a job in that field, and while I was weighing up my options, I took a temporary job at the BBC. It may sound glamorous working just over the road from Broadcasting House in the centre of London, but I can assure you it wasn't. I worked as an audio typist, typing up the unedited versions of radio broadcasts. I had to include all the hesitations, all the ums, the ers, the coughs, and everything that would need to be edited out before the programme was broadcastable. It really wasn't a very interesting job. I was quite relieved when my temporary contract came to an end, but it meant I was looking for work again. But the RNIB came up trumps again, because they were looking for Braille proofreaders at the time. I was quite cheeky, I think, applying for the job of a Braille proofreader, because at the time I'd only been reading Braille for about 3 years. Still, I had recently passed the Braille proficiency exam, so I suppose that indicated I knew the rules of Braille pretty well, and they took me on. I enjoyed the time I spent at the RNIB. We worked in central London, and it took me about 3/4 of an hour every day to travel to work, and the same to travel back in the evening, which was quite tiring, but I did enjoy the work itself. There were three distinct teams of proofreaders and transcribers. One concentrated on magazines, such as the Radio Times and the TV Times, and all the monthly magazines which the RNIB produced. They worked to strict deadlines and virtually did the same week in, week out. Another team concentrated on Braille music. We didn't have much contact with them, as we were in the students' library and we concentrated on textbooks and examination question papers. The process of getting text into Braille is probably different now from it was then. Some of it was computerised, although OCR wasn't used as far as I'm aware. Everything had to be typed either into a computer or onto a Perkins Brailler. Then, when the proofreaders were proofreading, there would be a transcriber with the print and a proofreader with the Braille. A proofreader would read out one braille page, which the transcriber would follow in the print, and then the transcriber would read from the print until the next braille page was over, and then the process would reverse again. A lot of the work that we did was transcribed by hand onto Perkins brailers. This was mainly because of the complexity of some of the material. We proofread and produced textbooks for students studying all kinds of subjects, from English, history, French, German, Latin, sciences, and there were even people studying degree subjects in engineering and Russian, which I remember very well. There was only one proofreader who knew any Russian, so she got all of that to proofread. But I remember doing some of the engineering, and it was quite involved. I had to learn the Braille Maths Code, which I'd never studied before, and the Braille German and French codes. So it was quite a challenging but an interesting job. The best time, I think, and perhaps also the most stressful, was around April and May of every year, because this is when we had the exam question papers to produce. We proofread exam papers for students taking exams right from GCSE or O-level, which students sit at the age of 16, through A-levels, which people take at 18, right up to degree level. And each of the exam papers had to be proofread twice, to make doubly sure that no errors were left. We had all kinds of subjects to proofread again here, Russian and engineering among them, plus Welsh, Latin, Greek even, and there were two proofreaders who could read Greek, thankfully, as well as all the mainstream subjects. But the biggest challenge for everybody were the exam papers which we produced for African countries. They had to be produced in Britain, apparently because they didn't have the facilities to produce them in Africa themselves. And these exam papers could be in any one of probably five or six different African languages. I remember we did Swahili, Shona and Sesotho, but there were more besides. And nobody knew a word of any of these languages, so someone had to transcribe them from print, then two different people had to proofread them. And the only way we could proofread them was to pronounce the words phonetically and go through them very slowly and very painstakingly and just hope that we caught all the errors. It was very rewarding. At the end of the exam season, when we got letters of thanks from the exam boards and from students who'd been able to have their exam papers in Braille thanks to us. Any diagrams which appeared in textbooks or exam papers had to be produced by hand. Some of the transcribers spent hours producing the most wonderful diagrams, and then we proofreaders had to look at them and try and make sense of them. They used different kinds of wires of different textures, and tin foil, cardboard, lots of glue, anything which would stand out in a tactile manner. The RNIB only rented the building where we worked, and they decided that the time had come to build a new purpose-built building out of London. So we were all told that our building was closing and our jobs were being transferred to a town called Peterborough, which is about 85 miles north of London. If we wanted to go to Peterborough, then there would be jobs there for us. If we didn't, then we would have to take our redundancy or severance pay. By this time I had got rather tired of London. The travelling was getting a bit much, and I'd been doing the job for a while and thought it was probably time for a change. I also found out that a new technology college had opened just near to where my parents lived in Lincolnshire, so I decided to enrol on a course there and continue my computer education, and so I left London for good. I wasn't sorry to leave. I like going back to London every now and again, but I wouldn't want to live there anymore. So, part two of my career starts with my enrolment at the Technology College. I was there for a year, and during that time I came across a speech synthesizer for the very first time. It was the Apollo version 1. And I used Howl, the screen reader produced by Dolphin here in the UK. I can't remember what the first version of Howl was which I came across. I think it was version 2 point something. There were people on my course at the Technology College doing all kinds of work to do with PCs. There weren't any strict courses. You just did what you wanted when you got there. I was interested in programming, so I started studying DBase 3+, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. The college had links with a few local employers, and quite often people used to go on work placements to various companies in the area. After I'd been at the college for a year, I went on a 3-month placement to the Swedish telecommunications company Ericsson, who had a factory in a town only a few miles away. When my 3 months was up, I was offered a permanent job, and there my career with Ericsson began. I programmed using a language called Clipper, which is based very much on DBase 3+, but with each version of Clipper, more elements of the C language were introduced, and so in the end, the final version of Clipper I used didn't bear very much resemblance to its DBase 3+ original. After a year or two, I also started studying Visual Basic, which I found quite challenging. Actually, writing the code was not too difficult, but the screen design was the area which I found most challenging. In Visual Basic, if you have a form and you want to place an object on the form, such as a text box or a button or a label, the object is immediately put right in the centre of the form, and you have to move it. For those people who are mouse dependent, that's not a problem. You just click on the object and drag it across to where you want it to go. But for people who don't use the mouse, that's not quite so easy. You have to look at the properties of the object and alter the coordinates of where it should actually be. The measurement, the unit of measurement used in Visual Basic, can be one of a number of things, but the recommendation is to use something called the TWIP. There are 20 twips to the point and 72 points to the inch, which means there are 1,440 twips to the inch. So you can be dealing with some rather large numbers when you're designing a form in Visual Basic. Objects have a standard size, but you can increase or decrease this if you want to. And of course, if you want everything to be neatly laid out on your form, you have to do quite a bit of involved calculation. I did eventually get the hang of it, but I must say I wasn't sorry when I stopped designing forms in Visual Basic. By that time, I'd moved on to using Windows, first Windows 95 and then Windows 98. Clipper was a DOS-based language, but once I started using Windows, I was introduced to JAWS. I started on version 2.0, I think it was. A lot of my development work, though, remained in DOS, because by the time Windows came along, we already had quite a few applications written in DOS which worked perfectly well when run in DOS Windows under Windows itself. And there didn't seem much point in converting those into Windows applications. The main application I wrote while I was at Ericsson's was to deal with the export of goods. We had to export things to all points of the world. Ericsson is a global company and it has factories, installations or whatever in over 100 countries. Or it certainly did then. I think it has scaled down quite a bit over the years. But at the height of its popularity, it was certainly a global brand. We used to ship goods to everywhere you could think of. We had a huge contract with the Philippines, and consignments went on a very regular basis over to the Philippines and many other countries besides. The export system I wrote handled all the packaging details of all the goods that we were sending out, which boxes contained what, how much everything weighed, and so on. And it also produced lists for the shipments of what was produced in each box so that everything would tally. There were some fairly sensitive countries that we sent things to, and the paperwork had to be spot on. Every month we also had to produce details for the customs and excise people in Britain about what we were exporting. Every single component has something called a tariff code, which is an 8-digit number, and we had to calculate how many of each item we were sending out of the country so that we didn't exceed the tariffs for any particular item. And we had a large turnover of goods, not only things that we were selling abroad, but things which had been sent back to the UK for repair and then were being sent out again. Strangely enough, when we went on holiday one year to North America, we flew to Montreal, and when our coach left the airport, one of the very first buildings we saw had Ericsson written right across the top of it. I just couldn't get away from the place. Most of the equipment I used when I was at Ericsson, the specialised equipment such as the Apollo synthesizer and various versions of JAWS and a scanner which I had, an old HP 3P I think it was, most of that equipment was provided by a scheme we have over here called Access to Work. Access to Work is supposed to help disabled people get employment and remove some of the barriers to employment, if possible, by providing equipment which allows disabled people to do their jobs and also providing the means for them to get to their place of work if public transport isn't available. We used to work rather odd hours at Ericsson. We started at 7:40 in the morning and left at 4:30 at night. And the public transport system in this part of the country is less than perfect. There was no chance of me getting a bus the 10 miles to Ericsson to be there by 7:40 in the morning. So Access to Work helped pay for a taxi to get me to work and back every day, which was a wonderful help. Towards the end of the year 2000, rumours were getting even more prevalent that the end was nigh for our factory. We had heard rumours for quite a few years. Once every big contract that Ericsson had came to an end, there were rumours that there would be no more and that we were finished. But then another contract would come along and everything would be fine again. But by late 2000, it seemed as if this time things really might have taken a turn for the worse. We found out that Ericsson were laying off a lot of staff in Sweden, their headquarters, and we felt sure that perhaps this was going to happen to us. I remember the day very well in February 2001 when the managing director called us all into a big meeting room and told us that we were going to be made redundant. The factory was closing and production of mobile phones, which were being made by that time, was being moved out to the Far East, and the rest of the work that we did was being sent out to third-party companies in Britain, or was going to be handled in the other Ericsson businesses throughout the country. Some of us were offered jobs down in the south, but I, for one, didn't want to uproot again. I didn't fancy moving another 200 miles south just to keep the job that I was getting a bit tired of by then. So I decided the time had come to move on. Part two had come to an end. So I took my redundancy and started looking for work again. One very positive thing that Ericsson did for us, though, was to hire a firm of consultants. And these people were excellent. They helped us look for jobs. They gave us tips on interview techniques. I even had a mock interview with one lady where she was asking the kind of questions I would be likely to come across in a job interview. They also told us the sort of thing to write in a resume or a CV. They told us how to fill in application forms, what kind of things to include, what kind of things to leave out. And it was so useful. I was actually very fortunate because I found a job advertised in the local press for a software developer at our local authority, which was in the same town as Ericsson. And I thought, well, might as well apply for this because IT jobs in this area are fairly thin on the ground. So with the help of the consultants, I filled in the application form, and with all their interview tips and techniques running through my head, I went for an interview and I got the job. And I was so lucky because I finished work at Ericsson's on the 11th of May in the year 2001, and on the 18th of May I went for my interview at the local authority. And on the 21st of May, I found out I'd got the job. So I just still can't believe how fortunate I was. It really just worked out so well. There was one problem, though. I was going to be developing applications in a totally new language called Lotus Notes. I'd never used Lotus Notes before, but apparently neither had most other people that the local authority was trying to attract to the job, because they had decided they couldn't find a fully qualified Lotus Notes developer. They were going to have to take on a software developer and then train them up to use Lotus Notes. So I had an assessment by Access to Work to see what I would need to enable me to do the job. And they highly recommended that a braille display would be needed. Now, I'd never used a braille display before. I'd seen a version of one at the RNIB, a very ancient one where we used to do some correcting of work which had been produced on computer. But I'd never used one myself, connected to a PC. As those of you who've come across Braille displays may know, they are extremely expensive, especially the 80-cell model, which is the one that was recommended for me. I'm not sure why they thought I would need an 80-cell model. It is enormous. It takes up a large portion of my desk. My keyboard sits on top of it, and there's Braille display several inches to each side of my full-size keyboard, plus some Braille display behind, and the main part with the Braille cells in front of the keyboard. So it is a big, big beast, and it's very heavy as well. But because of the cost of this piece of equipment, there was quite a delay in acquiring the funding needed to buy it. So I had to wait a few months, which was no great hardship really, because I'd had my severance pay from Ericsson, so I could manage through the summer and just have a bit of a break, which I think did me the world of good. Because the last few months at Ericsson, after we found out that things were coming to an end, were quite hectic and quite distressing, really, with people worrying about their futures. Anyway, the Braille display was finally acquired, and I began work, not really knowing what to expect. Lotus Notes was a complete unknown for me, as I've said, but I was lucky to have some very good training. I had two separate training courses. The first one lasted 3 days and the second one lasted 2 days of one-to-one training from an excellent teacher who not only taught me about Lotus Notes but was willing to sit and work with me to find out the best way of doing things without using the mouse. And we just about got it cracked in those 5 days of training. We worked out the best way of accessing various parts of the user interface, which is really quite different from what I'd used before. Thankfully, the problems of screen design in Visual Basic do not exist in Lotus Notes. You just create a field and create a label, and they grow as big as they need to be. You put a button on a form and it's positioned nicely for you. There's no problem there. Most of the work we did to start with was to write applications which were used within the mail client of Lotus Notes itself. There's a great deal of integration between the actual email side of Notes and the application side. So if you open your inbox in Lotus Notes, you can then go to somewhere called your workspace, just click on an icon, and this will open an application for you, which also appears just on top of your inbox. It sounds very strange for those who use Outlook and Outlook Express, as I had done for email before then, but the integration is superb. And the security within Lotus Notes is better than anything I've come across in any other application. It really is extremely good. After a year or two, though, we decided that there was more benefit to be gained by writing applications still in Lotus Notes, but which would be viewed in a web browser. This involved learning quite a bit of JavaScript and quite a bit of HTML, because the Lotus Notes application is made up of probably 4 or even 5 languages. Different things are written in different languages. Screen design is mainly written in HTML. Code behind buttons on a form can be written in JavaScript, or it can be written in Lotus Notes' native language, called the formula language. And little pieces of code that need to run, which are called agents, are written in something called Lotus Script, which was very much like the BASIC, which I'd used in Visual Basic. It sounds very peculiar, I must say, but when you run a Lotus Notes application in a web browser, you don't know what language it's been written in. It just looks like any other web application. My work now involves looking after our intranet and developing that. And we're also working on a very long-term project which will replace a lot of the paper forms which are generated when new people join the authority, when people leave, and when people have a change of job or wish to change any of their personal details which are held about them on our personnel and our payroll systems. These forms are really going to be the link between our personnel and payroll systems. At present, there is no link, and we want the information in those two systems to be as close as it possibly can be. There are just two of us developing Lotus Notes applications, and there's always plenty to do. But I enjoy the work, and it's satisfying, as Joni said on her career podcast. If you've had a good day, it's normally because you've been busy and you've achieved something. And I agree with that sentiment. I do get satisfaction from the work I do. I do have bad days, I do grumble about it, but then so does everyone. But on the whole, I think working gives me a great sense of satisfaction, a great sense of self-worth, and I certainly wouldn't want to be without it. So that's brought us up to the present day. As I said, part three of my career is still in progress, and we'll just have to see if there will be a part four. I think that's all I have to tell you for today. For those of you still listening, thank you for getting through to the end, and I hope you've found something of interest. But as I say, if anyone has any questions, please feel free to contact me. But for now, I'll say goodbye, and thank you for listening, and I'll speak to you again sometime soon.